chronic mental states, and he anticipates a possible objection to this distinction. Someone might dispute the fact that all calculations are non-iconic on the grounds that when he calculates, sometimes he does so by visualizing the calculation on a page. But this is not a counterexample, for what is represented in such cases is not the calculation itself, but a representation of it. It is numbers that are calculated, but what is visualized are numerals, which represent numbers. Leibniz, on the other hand, makes a tantalizing analogy between numbers and music. The pleasure we obtain from music comes from counting, but counting unconsciously. Music is nothing but unconscious arithmetic. What, so far as we can ascertain, is the situation with the twins and perhaps others? Ernst Toch, the composer, his grandson Lawrence Weskler tells me, could readily hold in his mind, after a single hearing, a very long string of numbers. But he did this by converting the string of numbers to a tune, a melody he himself shaped corresponding to the numbers. Jedediah Buxton, one of the most ponderous but tenacious calculators of all time, and a man who had a veritable, even pathological, passion for calculation and counting, he would become, in his own words, drunk with reckoning, would convert music and drama to numbers. During the dance, a contemporary account of him recorded in 1754, he fixed his attention upon the number of steps. He declared, after a fine piece of music, that the innumerable sounds produced by the music had perplexed him beyond measure, and he attended even to Mr. Garrick only to count the words that he uttered, in which he said he perfectly succeeded. Here is a pretty of extreme pair of examples: the musician who turns numbers into music, and the counter who turns music into numbers. One could scarcely have, one feels, more opposite sorts of mind, or at least more opposite modes of mind. I believe the twins, who have an extraordinary feeling for numbers, without being able to calculate at all, are allied not to Buxton, but to Toch in this matter. Except, and this we ordinary people find so difficult to imagine, except that they do not convert numbers into music, but actually feel them in themselves as forms, as tones, like the multitudinous forms that compose nature itself. They are not calculators, and their numeracy is iconic. They summon up, they dwell among strange scenes of numbers. They wander freely in great landscapes of numbers. They create, dramaturgically, a whole world made of numbers. They have, I believe, a most singular imagination. And not the least of its singularities is that it can imagine only numbers. They do not seem to operate with numbers, non-iconically, like a calculator. They see them directly as a vast natural scene. And if one asks, are there analogies, at least, to such an iconicity, one would find this, I think, in certain scientific minds. Dmitri Mendeleev, for example, carried around with him, written on cards, the numerical properties of elements until they became utterly familiar to him, so familiar that he no longer thought of them as aggregates of properties, but, so he tells us, as familiar faces. He now saw the elements, iconically, physiognomically, as faces. Faces that related like members of a family and that made up in toto, periodically arranged, the whole formal face of the universe. Such a scientific mind is essentially iconic and sees all nature as faces and scenes, perhaps as music as well. This vision, this inner vision suffused with the phenomenal, nonetheless has an integral relation with the physical, and returning it from the psychical to the physical constitutes the secondary or external work of such science. The philosopher seeks to hear within himself the echoes of the world symphony, writes Nietzsche, and to reproject them in the form of concepts. The twins, though morons, hear the world symphony, I conjecture, but hear it entirely in the form of numbers. The soul is harmonical, whatever one's IQ, and for some, like physical scientists and mathematicians, the sense of harmony, perhaps, is chiefly intellectual. And yet, I cannot think of anything intellectual that is not in some way also sensible. Indeed, the very word sense always has this double connotation. Sensible, and in some sense personal as well, for one cannot feel anything, find anything sensible, unless it is in some way related or relatable to oneself. Thus the mighty architectonics of Bach provide, as they did for Martin A., an hieroglyphical and shadowed lesson of the whole world, but they are also recognizably, uniquely, dearly Bach. And this too was felt poignantly by Martin A., and related by him to the love he bore his father. The twins, I believe, have not just a strange faculty, but a sensibility, a harmonic sensibility, perhaps allied to that of music. One might speak of it, very naturally, as a Pythagorean sensibility. And what is odd is not its existence, but that it is apparently so rare. One's soul is harmonical, whatever one's IQ. And perhaps the need to find or feel some ultimate harmony or order is a universal of the mind, whatever its powers and whatever form it takes. Mathematics has always been called the queen of sciences, and mathematicians have always felt number as the great mystery, and the world as organized, mysteriously, by the power of number. This is beautifully expressed in the prologue to Bertrand Russell's autobiography. With equal passion I have sought knowledge. I have wished to understand the hearts of men. I have wished to know why the stars shine. And I have tried to apprehend the Pythagorean power by which number holds sway above the flux. It is strange to compare these moron twins to an intellect, a spirit like that of Bertrand Russell. And yet it is not, I think, so far-fetched. The twins live exclusively in a thought world of numbers. They have no interest in the stars shining or the hearts of men. And yet numbers for them, I believe, are not just numbers, but significances. Signifiers whose significand is the world. They do not approach numbers lightly, as most calculators do. They are not interested in, have no capacity for, cannot comprehend calculations. They are rather serene contemplators of number, and approach numbers with a sense of reverence and awe. Numbers for them are holy, fraught with significance. This is their way, as music is Martin's way, of apprehending the first composer. But numbers are not just awesome for them, they are friends too. Perhaps the only friends they have known in their isolated, autistic lives. This is a rather common sentiment among people who have a talent for numbers. And Stephen Smith, while seeing method as all-important, gives many delightful examples of it. George Parker Bidder, who wrote of his early number childhood, "I became perfectly familiar with numbers up to 100. They became, as it were, my friends. And I knew all their relations and acquaintances," or the contemporary Shyam Marathe from India. When I say that numbers are my friends, I mean that I have some time in the past dealt with that particular number in a variety of ways, and on many occasions have found new and fascinating qualities hidden in it. So if in a calculation I come across a known number, I immediately look to him as a friend. Hermann von Helmholtz, speaking of musical perception, says that though compound tones can be analyzed and broken down into their components, they are normally heard as qualities, unique qualities of tone, indivisible wholes. He speaks here of a synthetic perception which transcends analysis and is the unanalyzable essence of all musical sense. He compares such tones to faces and speculates that we may recognize them in somewhat the same personal way. In brief, he half suggests that musical tones, and certainly tunes, are, in fact, faces for the ear, and are recognized, felt, immediately as persons or personeities, a recognition involving warmth, emotion, personal relation. Particularly fascinating and fundamental problems are raised by the perception and recognition of faces. For there is much evidence that we recognize faces, at least familiar faces, directly, and not by any process of piecemeal analysis or aggregation. This, as we have seen, is most dramatically shown in prosopagnosia, in which, as a consequence of a lesion in the right occipital cortex, patients become unable to recognize faces as such, and have to employ an elaborate, absurd, and indirect route, involving a bit-by-bit analysis of meaningless and separate features. So it seems to be with those who love numbers. These two become recognizable as such in a single, intuitive, personal, I know you. The mathematician Wim Kline has put this well. Numbers are friends for me, more or less. It doesn't mean the same for you, does it? 3,844? For you it's just a 3 and an 8 and a 4 and a 4. But I say, hi, 62 squared. I believe the twins, seemingly so isolated, live in a world full of friends, that they have millions, billions of numbers to which they say hi, and which, I am sure, say hi back. But none of the numbers is arbitrary, like 62 squared. Nor, and this is the mystery, is it arrived at by any of the usual methods or any method so far as I can make out. The twins seem to employ a direct cognition, like angels. They see, directly, a universe and heaven of numbers. And this, however singular, however bizarre, but what right have we to call it pathological, provides a singular self-sufficiency and serenity to their lives, and one which it might be tragic to interfere with or break. This serenity was, in fact, interrupted and broken up 10 years later, when it was felt that the twins should be separated, for their own good, to prevent their unhealthy communication together, and in order that they could come out and face the world in an appropriate, socially acceptable way, as the medical and sociological jargon had it. They were separated then, in 1977, with results that might be considered as either gratifying or dire. Both have been moved now into halfway houses and do menial jobs for pocket money under close supervision. They are able to take buses, if carefully directed and given a token, and to keep themselves moderately presentable and clean, though their moronic and psychotic character is still recognizable at a glance. This is the positive side. But there is a negative side, too, not mentioned in their charts, because it was never recognized in the first place. Deprived of their numerical communion with each other, and of time and opportunity for any contemplation or communion at all, they are always being hurried and jostled from one job to another. They seem to have lost their strange numerical power. And with this, the chief joy and sense of their lives. But this is considered a small price to pay, no doubt, for their having become quasi-independent and socially acceptable. One is reminded somewhat of the treatment meted out to Nadia, an autistic child with a phenomenal gift for drawing. Nadia, too, was subjected to a therapeutic regime to find ways in which her potentialities in other directions could be maximized. The net effect was that she started talking and stopped drawing. Nigel Dennis comments, "We are left with a genius who has had her genius removed, leaving nothing behind but a general defectiveness." What are we supposed to think about such a curious cure? It should be added This is a point dwelt on by F.W.H. Myers, whose consideration of number prodigies opens his chapter on genius, that the faculty is strange and may disappear spontaneously, though it is, as often, lifelong. In the case of the twins, of course, it was not just a faculty, but the personal and emotional center of their lives. And now they are separated, now it is gone, there is no longer any sense or center to their lives. On the other hand, should this discussion be thought too singular or perverse, it is important to note that in the case of the twins studied by Luria, their separation was essential for their own development, unlocked them from a meaningless and sterile Babylon bind, and permitted them to develop as healthy and creative people. Postscript. When he was shown the manuscript of this paper, Israel Rosenfield pointed out that there are other arithmetics, higher and simpler than the conventional arithmetic of operations, and wondered whether the twins' singular powers and limitations might not reflect their use of such a modular arithmetic. In a note to me, he has speculated that modular algorithms of the sort described by Ian Stewart in Concepts of Modern Mathematics may explain the twins' calendrical abilities. Their ability to determine the days of the week within an 80,000-year period suggests a rather simple algorithm. One divides the total number of days between now and then by 7. If there is no remainder, then that date falls on the same day as now. If the remainder is 1, then that date is 1 day later, and so on. Notice that modular arithmetic is cyclic. It consists of repetitive patterns. Perhaps the twins were visualizing these patterns, either in the form of easily constructed charts or some kind of landscape, like a spiral of integers. This leaves unanswered why the twins communicate in primes. But calendar arithmetic requires the prime of 7, and if one is thinking of modular arithmetic in general, modular division will produce neat cyclic patterns only if one uses prime numbers. Since the prime number 7 helps the twins to retrieve dates, and consequently the events of particular days in their lives, other primes they may have found produce similar patterns to those that are so important for their acts of recollection. When they say about the matchsticks, 111, 37, 3 times, note they are taking the prime 37 and multiplying by 3. In fact, only the prime patterns could be visualized. The different patterns produced by the different prime numbers, for example, multiplication tables, may be the pieces of visual information that they are communicating to each other when they repeat a given prime number. In short, modular arithmetic may help them to retrieve their past, and consequently the patterns created in using these calculations, which only occur with primes, may take on a particular significance for the twins. By the use of such a modular arithmetic, Ian Stewart points out, one may rapidly arrive at a unique solution in situations that defeat any ordinary arithmetic. In particular, homing in, by the so-called pigeonhole principle, on extremely large and, by conventional methods, incomputable primes. If such methods, such visualizations are regarded as algorithms, they are algorithms of a very peculiar sort, organized not algebraically but spatially, as trees, spirals, architectures, thoughtscapes, configurations in a formal yet quasi-sensory mental space. I have been excited by Israel Rosenfield's comments and Ian Stewart's expositions of higher and especially modular arithmetics, for these seem to promise, if not a solution, at least a powerful illumination of otherwise inexplicable powers, like those of the twins. Such higher or deeper arithmetics were conceived in principle by Gauss in his Disquisitiones Arithmeticae in 1801, but they have only been turned to practical realities in recent years. One has to wonder whether there may not be a conventional arithmetic, that is, an arithmetic of operations, often irritating to teacher and student, unnatural and hard to learn, and also a deep arithmetic of the kind described by Gauss, which may be truly innate to the brain, as innate as Chomsky's deep syntax and generative grammars. Such an arithmetic in minds like the twins could be dynamic and almost alive. Globular clusters and nebulae of numbers whirling and evolving in an ever-expanding mental sky. As already mentioned, after publication of The Twins, I received a great deal of communication, both personal and scientific. Some dealt with the specific themes of seeing or apprehending numbers, some with the sense of significance which might attach to this phenomenon, some with the general character of autistic dispositions and sensibilities and how they might be fostered or inhibited, and some with the question of identical twins. Especially interesting were the letters from parents of such children, the rarest and most remarkable from parents who had themselves been forced into reflection and research, and who had succeeded in combining the deepest feeling and involvement with a profound objectivity. In this category were the Parks. Highly gifted parents of a highly gifted but autistic child. The Parks' child, Ella, was a talented drawer and was also highly gifted with numbers, especially in her earlier years. She was fascinated by the order of numbers, especially primes. This peculiar feel for primes is evidently not uncommon. Clara Claiborne Park wrote to me of another autistic child she knew who covered sheets of paper with numbers written down compulsively. All were primes, she noted, and added, "They are windows into another world." Later she mentioned a recent experience with a young autistic man who was also fascinated by factors and primes, and how he instantly perceived these as special. Indeed, the word special must be used to elicit a reaction. "Anything special, Joe, about that number, 4,875? Joe: "It's just divisible by 13 and 25. Of another, 7,241. "It's divisible by 13 and 557. And of 8,741. "It's a prime number." Park comments, "No one in his family reinforces his primes. They are a solitary pleasure." It is not clear in these cases how the answers are arrived at almost instantaneously, whether they are worked out, known, remembered, or somehow just seen. What is clear is the peculiar sense of pleasure and significance attaching to primes. Some of this seems to go with a sense of formal beauty and symmetry, but some with a peculiar associational meaning or potency. This was often called magical in Ella's case. Numbers, especially primes, called up special thoughts, images, feelings, relationships, some almost too special or magical to be mentioned. This is well described in David Park's paper. Kurt Gödel, in a wholly general way, has discussed how numbers, especially primes, can serve as markers for ideas, people, places, whatever. And such a Gödelian marking would pave the way for an arithmetization or numeralization of the world. If this does occur, it is possible that the twins and others like them do not merely live in a world of numbers, but in a world, in the world, as numbers, their number meditation or play being a sort of existential meditation. And if one can understand it, or find the key, as David Park sometimes does, a strange and precise communication, too. Chapter 24. The Autist Artist. "Draw this," I said, and gave Jose my pocket watch. He was about 21, said to be hopelessly retarded, and had earlier had one of the violent seizures from which he suffers. He was thin, fragile-looking. His distraction, his restlessness, suddenly ceased. He took the watch carefully as if it were a talisman or jewel, laid it before him and stared at it in motionless concentration. "He's an idiot," the attendant broke in. "Don't even ask him. He don't know what it is. He can't tell time. He can't even talk. They say he's autistic, but he's just an idiot." Jose turned pale, perhaps more at the attendant's tone than at his words. The attendant had said earlier that Jose didn't use words.
"Go on," I said. "I know you can do it."
Jose drew with an absolute stillness, concentrating completely on the little clock before him. Everything else shut out. Now, for the first time, he was bold, without hesitation, composed, not distracted. He drew swiftly but minutely, with a clear line, without erasures. I nearly always ask patients, if it is possible for them, to write and draw, partly as a rough-and-ready index of various competences, but also as an expression of character or style. Jose had drawn the watch with remarkable fidelity, putting in every feature, at least every essential feature. He did not put in West clocks, shock-resistant, made in USA. Not just the time, though this was faithfully registered as 11:31, but every second as well, and the inset seconds dial. And not least, the knurled winder and trapezoid clip of the watch used to attach it to a chain. The clip was strikingly amplified, though everything else remained in due proportion. And the figures, now that I came to look at them, were of different sizes, different shapes, different styles, some thick, some thin, some aligned, some inset, some plain, and some elaborated, even a bit gothic. And the inset second hand, rather inconspicuous in the original, had been given a striking prominence, like the small inner dials of star clocks or astrolabes. The general grasp of the thing, its feel, had been strikingly brought out. All the more strikingly if, as the attendant said, Jose had no idea of time. And otherwise, there was an odd mixture of close, even obsessive accuracy, with curious, and I felt, droll elaborations and variations. I was puzzled by this, haunted by it as I drove home. An idiot? Autism? No. Something else was going on here. I was not called to see Jose again. The first call on a Sunday evening had been for an emergency. He had been having seizures the entire weekend, and I had prescribed changes in his anticonvulsants over the phone in the afternoon. Now that his seizures were controlled, further neurological advice was not requested. But I was still troubled by the problems presented by the clock, and felt an unresolved sense of mystery about it. I needed to see him again. So I arranged a further visit, and to see his entire chart. I had been given only a consultation slip, not very informative when I saw him before. Jose came casually into the clinic. He had no idea, and perhaps did not care why he'd been called, but his face lit up with a smile when he saw me. The dull, indifferent look, the mask I remembered, was lifted. There was a sudden, shy smile, like a glimpse through a door. "I have been thinking about you, Jose," I said. He might not understand my words, but he understood my tone. "I want to see more drawing." And I gave him my pen. What should I ask him to draw this time? I had, as always, a copy of Arizona Highways with me, a richly illustrated magazine which I especially delight in, and which I carry around for neurological purposes for testing my patients. The cover depicted an idyllic scene of people canoeing on a lake against a backdrop of mountains and sunset. Jose started with the foreground, a mass of near black silhouetted against the water, outlined this with extreme accuracy, and started to block it in. But this was clearly a job for a paintbrush, not a fine pen. "Skip it," I said, then pointing, "go on to the canoe." Rapidly, unhesitatingly, Jose outlined the silhouetted figures and the canoe. He looked at them, then looked away, their forms fixed in his mind, then swiftly blocked them in with the side of the pen. Here again, and more impressively, because an entire scene was involved, I was amazed at the swiftness and the minute accuracy of reproduction, the more so since Jose had gazed at the canoe and then away, having taken it in. This argued strongly against any mere copying. The attendant had said earlier he's just a Xerox, and suggested that he had apprehended it as an image, exhibiting a striking power not just of copying, but of perception. For the image had a dramatic quality not present in the original. The tiny figures, enlarged, were more intense, more alive, had a feeling of involvement and purpose not at all clear in the original. All the hallmarks of what Richard Wolheim calls iconicity, subjectivity, intentionality, dramatization, were present. Thus, over and over, the powers of mere facsimile, striking as these were, he seemed to have clear powers of imagination and creativity. It was not a canoe, but his canoe, that emerged in the drawing. I turned to another page in the magazine, to an article on trout fishing, with a pastel watercolor of a trout stream, a background of rocks and trees, and in the foreground, a rainbow trout about to take a fly. "Draw this," I said, pointing to the fish. He gazed at it intently, seemed to smile to himself, and then turned away. And now, with obvious enjoyment, his smile growing broader and broader, he drew a fish of his own. I smiled myself, involuntarily, as he drew it, because now, feeling comfortable with me, he was letting himself go. And what was emerging, slyly, was not just a fish, but a fish with a character of sorts. The original had lacked character, had looked lifeless, two-dimensional, even stuffed. Jose's fish, by contrast, tilted and poised, was richly three-dimensional, far more like a real fish than the original. It was not only verisimilitude and animation that had been added, but something else, something richly expressive, though not wholly fish-like. A great cavernous, whale-like mouth, a slightly crocodilian snout, an eye, one had to say, which was distinctly human, and with altogether a positively roguish look. It was very funny fish. No wonder he had smiled. A sort of fish person, a nursery character like the frog footman in Alice. Now I had something to go on. The picture of the clock had startled me, stimulated my interest, but did not, in itself, allow any thoughts or conclusions. The canoe had shown that Jose had an impressive visual memory and more. The fish showed a lively and distinctive imagination, a sense of humor, and something akin to fairy tale art. Certainly not great art. It was primitive. Perhaps it was child art. But without doubt, it was art of a sort. And imagination, playfulness, art are precisely what one does not expect in idiots or idiot savants, or in the autistic either. Such, at least, is the prevailing opinion. My friend and colleague, Isabelle Crepin, had actually seen Jose years before, when he was presented with intractable seizures in the child neurology clinic, and she, with her great experience, did not doubt that he was autistic. Of autism in general, she had written, "A small number of autistic children are exceedingly proficient at decoding written language and become hyperlexic or preoccupied with numbers. Extraordinary proficiencies of some autistic children for putting together puzzles, taking apart mechanical toys, or decoding written texts may reflect the consequences of attention and learning being inordinately focused on nonverbal visual-spatial tasks to the exclusion of, or perhaps because of, the lack of demand for learning verbal skills." Somewhat similar observations, specifically about drawing, are made by Lorna Self in her astonishing book Nadia. All idiot savant or autistic proficiencies and performances, Dr. Self gathered from the literature, were apparently based on calculation and memory alone, never on anything imaginative or personal. And if these children could draw, supposedly a very rare occurrence, their drawings too were merely mechanical. Isolated islands of proficiency and splinter skills are spoken of in the literature. No allowance is made for an individual, let alone a creative personality. What then was Jose, I had to ask myself? What sort of being? What went on inside him? How had he arrived at the state he was in? And what state was it? And might anything be done? I was both assisted and bewildered by the available information. The mass of data that had been gathered since the first onset of his strange illness, his state. I had a lengthy chart available to me, containing early descriptions of his original illness, a very high fever at the age of 8, associated with the onset of incessant and subsequently continuing seizures, and the rapid appearance of a brain-damaged or autistic condition. There had been doubt from the start about what exactly was going on. His spinal fluid had been abnormal during the acute stage of the illness. The consensus was that he had probably suffered an encephalitis of sorts. His seizures were of many different types, petit mal, grand mal, akinetic, and psychomotor, these last being seizures of an exceptionally complex type. Psychomotor seizures can also be associated with sudden passion and violence, and the occurrence of peculiar behavior states, even between seizures, the so-called psychomotor personality. They are invariably associated with disorder in or damage to the temporal lobes, and severe temporal lobe disorder, both left-sided and right-sided, had been demonstrated in Jose by innumerable EEGs. The temporal lobes are also associated with the auditory capacities, and, in particular, the perception and production of speech. Dr. Rapin had not only considered Jose autistic, but had wondered whether a temporal lobe disorder had caused a verbal auditory agnosia, an inability to recognize speech sounds that interfered with his capacity to use or understand the spoken word. For what was striking, however it was to be interpreted, and both psychiatric and neurological interpretations were offered, was the loss or regression of speech, so that Jose, previously normal, or so his parents avowed, became mute and ceased talking to others when he became ill. One capacity was apparently spared, perhaps in a compensatory way enhanced. An unusual passion and power to draw, which had been evident since early childhood and seemed to some extent hereditary or familial, for his father had always been fond of sketching, and his much older brother was a successful artist. With the onset of his illness, with his seemingly intractable seizures, he might have 20 or 30 major convulsions a day, and uncounted little seizures, falls, blanks, or dreamy states. With the loss of speech and his general intellectual and emotional regression, Jose found himself in a strange and tragic state. His schooling was discontinued, though a private tutor was provided for a while, and he was returned permanently to his family as a full-time epileptic, autistic, perhaps aphasic, retarded child. He was considered ineducable, untreatable, and generally hopeless. At the age of 9, he dropped out of school, out of society, out of almost all of what for a normal child would be reality. For 15 years, he scarcely emerged from the house, ostensibly because of intractable seizures, his mother maintaining she dared not take him out, otherwise he would have 20 or 30 seizures in the street every day. All sorts of anticonvulsants were tried, but his epilepsy seemed untreatable. This, at least, was the stated opinion in his chart. There were older brothers and sisters, but Jose was much the youngest, the big baby of a woman approaching 50. We have far too little information about these intervening years. Jose, in effect, disappeared from the world, was lost to follow up, not only medically but generally, and might have been lost forever, confined and convulsing in his cellar room,
Had he not blown up violently very recently and been taken to the hospital for the first time? He was not entirely without inner life in the cellar. He showed a passion for pictorial magazines, especially of natural history of the National Geographic type, and when he was able, between seizures and scoldings, would find stumps of pencil and draw what he saw. These drawings were perhaps his only link with the outside world, and especially the world of animals and plants, of nature, which he had so loved as a child, especially when he went out sketching with his father. This, and this only, he was permitted to retain, his one remaining link with reality. This, then, was the tale I received, or rather put together from his chart or charts, documents as remarkable for what they lacked as for what they contained. The documentation, through default of a 15-year gap, from a social worker who had visited the house, taken an interest in him, but could do nothing, and from his now aged and ailing parents as well. But none of this would have come to light had there not been a rage of sudden, unprecedented, and frightening violence, a fit in which objects were smashed, which brought Jose to a state hospital for the first time. It was far from clear what had caused this rage, whether it was an eruption of epileptic violence, such as one may see on rare occasions with very severe temporal lobe seizures, or whether it was, in the simplistic terms of his admission note, simply a psychosis, or whether it represented some final, desperate call for help from a tortured soul who was mute and had no direct way of expressing his predicament, his needs. What was clear was that coming to the hospital and having his seizures controlled by powerful new drugs for the first time gave him some space and freedom, a release, both physiological and psychological, of a sort he had not known since the age of 8. Hospitals, state hospitals, are often seen as total institutions in Irving Goffman's sense, geared mainly for the degradation of patients. Doubtless this happens, and on a vast scale, but they may also be asylums in the best sense of the word, a sense perhaps scarcely allowed by Goffman. Places that provide a refuge for the tormented, storm-tossed soul, provide it with just that mixture of order and freedom of which it stands in such need. Jose had suffered from confusion and chaos, partly organic epilepsy, partly the disorder of his life, and from confinement and bondage, also both epileptic and existential. Hospital was good for Jose, perhaps life-saving at this point in his life, and there is no doubt that he himself felt this fully. Suddenly, too, after the moral closeness, the febrile intimacy of his house, he now found others, found a world, both professional and concerned, unjudging, unmoralistic, unaccusing, detached, but at the same time with a real feeling both for him and for his problems. At this point, therefore, he had now been in hospital for 4 weeks. He started to have hope, to become more animated, to turn to others as he had never done before, not at least since the onset of autism when he was 8. But hope, turning to others, interaction was forbidden, and no doubt frighteningly complex and dangerous as well. Jose had lived for 15 years in a guarded, closed world, in what Bruno Bettelheim in his book on autism called the empty fortress. But it was not, it had never been for him, entirely empty. There had always been his love for nature, for animals and plants. This part of him, this door, had always remained open. But now there was temptation and pressure to interact. Pressure that was often too much, came too soon. And precisely at such time Jose would relapse, would turn again, as if for comfort and security, to the isolation, to the primitive rocking movements he had at first shown. The third time I saw Jose, I did not send for him in the clinic, but went up, without warning, to the admission ward. He was sitting, rocking in the frightful day room, his face and eyes closed, a picture of regression. I had a qualm of horror when I saw him like this, for I had imagined, had indulged, the notion of a steady recovery. I had to see Jose in a regressed condition, as I was to do again and again, to see that there was no simple awakening for him, but a path fraught with a sense of danger, double jeopardy, terrifying as well as exciting, because he had come to love his prison bars. As soon as I called him, he jumped up and eagerly, hungrily followed me to the art room. Once more I took a fine pen from my pocket, for he seemed to have an aversion to crayons, which was all they used on the ward. "That fish you drew?" I hinted it with a gesture in the air, not knowing how much of my words he might understand. "That fish? Can you remember it? Can you draw it again?" He nodded eagerly and took the pen from my hands. It was 3 weeks since he had seen it. What would he draw now? He closed his eyes for a moment, summoning an image, and then drew. It was still a trout, rainbow-spotted with fringy fins and a forked tail, but this time with egregiously human features. An odd nostril. What fish has nostrils? And a pair of ripely human lips. I was about to take the pen, but no, he was not finished. What had he in mind? The image was complete. The image, perhaps, but not the scene. The fish before had existed as an icon in isolation. Now it was to become part of a world, a scene. Rapidly he sketched in a little fish, a companion, swooping into the water, gambolling, obviously in play. And then the surface of the water was sketched in, rising to a sudden tumultuous wave. As he drew the wave, he became excited and emitted a strange, mysterious cry. I couldn't avoid the feeling, perhaps a facile one, that this drawing was symbolic. The little fish and the big fish, perhaps him and me. But what was so important and exciting was the spontaneous representation, the impulse, not my suggestion, entirely from himself, to introduce this new element, a living interplay in what he drew. In his drawings, as in his life hitherto, interaction had always been absent. Now, if only in play, in symbol, it was allowed back. Or was it? What was that angry, avenging wave? Best to go back to safe ground, I felt. No more free association. I had seen potential, but I had seen and heard danger, too. Back to safe, Edenic, prelapsarian Mother Nature. I found a Christmas card lying on the table, a robin redbreast on a tree trunk, snow and stark twigs all around. I gestured to the bird and gave Jose the pen. The bird was finely drawn, and he used a red pen for the breast. The feet were somewhat taloned, grasping the bark. I was struck here and later by his need to emphasize the grasping power of hands and feet, to make contact sure, almost gripping, obsessed. But what was happening? The dry winter twiglet next to the tree trunk had shot up in his drawing, expanded into florid open bloom. There were other things that were perhaps symbolic, although I could not be sure. But the salient and exciting and most significant transformation was this: that Jose had changed winter into spring. Now, finally, he started to speak. Though speak is much too strong a term for the strange-sounding, stumbling, largely unintelligible utterances that came out, on occasion startling him as much as they startled us. For all of us, Jose included, had regarded him as wholly and incorrigibly mute, whether from incapacity, indisposition, or both. There had been the attitude as well as the fact of not speaking. And here, too, we found it impossible to say how much was organic, how much was a matter of motivation. We had reduced, though not annulled, his temporal lobe disorders. His electroencephalograms, EEGs, were never normal. They still showed in these lobes a sort of low-grade electrical muttering,
occasional spikes, dysrhythmia, slow waves. But they were immensely improved compared with what they were when he came in. If he could remove their convulsiveness, he could not reverse the damage they had sustained. We had improved, it could not be doubted, his physiological potentials for speech, though there was an impairment of his abilities to use, understand, and recognize speech, with which doubtless he would always have to contend. But, equally important, he now was fighting for the recovery of his understanding and speech. Egged on by all of us, and guided by the speech therapist in particular, where previously he had accepted it, hopelessly or masochistically, and indeed had turned against virtually all communication with others, verbal and otherwise. Speech impairment and the refusal to speak had coupled before in the double malignancy of disease. Now, recovery of speech and attempts to speak were being happily coupled in the double benignity of beginning to get well. Even to the most sanguine of us, it was very apparent that Jose would never speak with any facility approaching normal, that speech could never, for him, be a real vehicle for self-expression, could serve only to express his simpler needs. And he himself seemed to feel this too, and while he continued to fight for speech, turned more fiercely to drawing for self-expression. One final episode. Jose had been moved off the frenzied admission ward to a calmer, quieter special ward, more homelike, less prison-like, than the rest of the hospital. A ward with an exceptional number and quality of staff, designed especially, as Bettelheim would say, as a home for the heart, for patients with autism who seem to require a kind of loving and dedicated attention that few hospitals can give. When I went up to this new ward, he waved his hand lustily as soon as he saw me, an outgoing, open gesture. I could not imagine him having done this before. He pointed to the locked door. He wanted it open. He wanted to go outside. He led the way downstairs, outside, into the overgrown, sunlit garden. So far as I could learn, he had not voluntarily gone outside since he was 8, since the very start of his illness and withdrawal. Nor did I have to offer him a pen. He took one himself. We walked around the hospital grounds, Jose sometimes gazing at the sky and trees, but more often down at his feet, at the mauve and yellow carpet of clover and dandelions beneath us. He had a very quick eye for plant forms and colors, rapidly saw and picked a rare white clover and found a still rarer four-leafed one. He found 7 different types of grass, no less, seemed to recognize, to greet each one as a friend. He was delighted most of all by the great yellow dandelions, open, all their florets flung open to the sun. This was his plant. It was how he felt, and to show his feeling he would draw it. The need to draw, to pay graphic reverence, was immediate and strong. He knelt down, placed his clipboard on the ground, and holding the dandelion, drew it. This, I think, is the first drawing from real life that Jose had done since his father took him sketching as a child, before he became ill. It is a splendid drawing, accurate and alive. It shows his love for reality, for another form of life. It is, to my mind, rather similar to, and not inferior to, the fine, vivid flowers one finds in medieval botanies and herbals, fastidiously, botanically exact, even though Jose has no formal knowledge of botany and could not be taught it or understand it if he tried. His mind is not built for the abstract, the conceptual. That is not available to him as a path to truth. But he has a passion and a real power for the particular. He loves it. He enters into it. He recreates it. And the particular, if one is particular enough, is also a road, one might say, nature's road, to reality and truth. The abstract, the categorical, has no interest for the autistic person. The concrete, the particular, the singular is all. Whether this is a question of capacity or disposition, it is strikingly the case.
Lacking or indisposed to the general, the autistic seem to compose their world picture entirely of particulars. Thus they live not in a universe, but in what William James called a multiverse of innumerable, exact, and passionately intense particulars. It is a mode of mind at the opposite extreme from the generalizing, the scientific, but still real, equally real, in a quite different way. Such a mind has been imagined in Borges's story Funes the Memorious, so like Luria's Mnemonist. He was, let us not forget, almost incapable of ideas of a general Platonic sort. In the teeming world of Funes, there were only details, almost immediate in their presence. No one has felt the heat and pressure of a reality as indefatigable as that which day and night converged upon the hapless Ireneo. As for Borges's Ireneo, so for José. But it is not necessarily a hapless circumstance. There may be a deep satisfaction in particulars, especially if they shine, as they may do for José, with an emblematic radiance. I think José, an autist, a simpleton too, has such a gift for the concrete, for form, that he is, in his way, a naturalist and natural artist. He grasps the world as forms, directly and intensely felt forms, and reproduces them. He has fine literal powers, but he has figurative powers too. He can draw a flower or fish with remarkable accuracy, but he can also make one which is a personification, an emblem, a dream, or a joke. And the autistic are supposed to lack imagination, playfulness, art. Creatures like José are not supposed to exist. Autistic child artists like Nadia were not supposed to exist. Are they indeed so rare, or are they overlooked? Nigel Dennis, in a brilliant essay on Nadia in the New York Review of Books, wonders how many of the world's Nadias may be dismissed or overlooked, their remarkable productions crumpled up and consigned to the trash can, or simply, like José, treated without thought as an odd talent, isolated, irrelevant, of no interest. But the autistic artist, or, to be less lofty, the autistic imagination, is by no means rare. I have seen a dozen examples of it in as many years, and this without making any particular effort to find them. The autistic, by their nature, are seldom open to influence. It is their fate to be isolated, and thus original. Their vision, if it can be glimpsed, comes from within and appears aboriginal. They seem to me, as I see more of them, to be a strange species in our midst, odd, original, wholly inwardly directed, unlike others. Autism was once seen as a childhood schizophrenia, but phenomenologically the reverse is the case. The schizophrenic's complaint is always of influence from the outside. He is passive, he is played upon, he cannot be himself. The autistic would complain, if they complained, of absence, of influence, of absolute isolation. No man is an island entire of itself, wrote Dunn. But this is precisely what autism is, an island cut off from the main. In classical autism, which is manifest and often total by the third year of life, the cutting off is so early there may be no memory of the main. In secondary autism, like José's, caused by brain disease at a later stage in life, there is some memory, perhaps some nostalgia for the main. This may explain why José was more accessible than most, and why, at least in drawing, he may show interplay taking place. Is being an island being cut off necessarily a death? It may be a death, but it is not necessarily so. For though horizontal connections with others, with society and culture, are lost, yet there may be vital and intensified
vertical connections, direct connections with nature, with reality, uninfluenced, unmediated, untouchable by any others. This vertical contact is very striking with Jose. Hence the piercing directness, the absolute clarity of his perceptions and drawings, without a hint or shade of ambiguity or indirection, a rock-like power uninfluenced by others. This brings us to our final question. Is there any place in the world for a man who is like an island, who cannot be acculturated, made part of the main? Can the main accommodate, make room for the singular? There are similarities here to the social and cultural reactions to genius. Of course, I do not suggest that all autists have genius, only that they share with genius the problem of singularity. Specifically, what does the future hold for Jose? Is there some place for him in the world which will employ his autonomy, but leave it intact? Could he, with his fine eye and great love of plants, make illustrations for botanical works or herbals? Be an illustrator for zoology or anatomy texts? Could he accompany scientific expeditions and make drawings? He paints and makes models with equal facility of rare species. His pure concentration on the thing before him would make him ideal in such situations. Or, to take a strange but not illogical leap, could he, with his peculiarities, his idiosyncrasy, do drawings for fairy tales, nursery tales, Bible tales, myths? Or, since he cannot read and sees letters only as pure and beautiful forms, could he not illustrate and elaborate the gorgeous capitals of manuscript breviaries and missals? He has done beautiful altarpieces in mosaic and stained wood for churches. He has carved exquisite lettering on tombstones. His current job is hand-printing sundry notices for the ward, which he does with the flourishes and elaborations of a latter-day Magna Carta. All this he could do, and do very well. And it would be of use and delight to others, and delight him too. He could do all of these. But alas, he will do none, unless someone very understanding and with opportunities and means can guide and employ him. For, as the stars stand, he will probably do nothing and spend a useless, fruitless life, as so many other autistic people do, overlooked, unconsidered, in the back ward of a state hospital.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and Other Clinical Tales, written by Oliver Sacks, narrated by Jonathan Davis, with an introduction written and read by Oliver Sacks. Executive Producer Steve Feldberg, Producer Mike Charzik, Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1970, 1981, 1983, 1984, and 1985 by Oliver Sacks. Production copyright 2011 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.